Life sustains itself by cell division. So does cancer. Breast cancer cells multiply faster because of CDK4/6 proteins. But what if we could block those proteins and stop runaway cell division? To that end, Dana-Farber scientists laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, new drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Dana-Farber's momentum of discovery keeps finding new ways to outmaneuver cancer. Learn more at DanaFarber.org/everywhere.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
You know, sometimes it really is all about the bottom line. Banks started reporting earnings this afternoon. Today on the broadcast, how to tell fact from fiction. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Cargill. Collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at cargill.com/creates. American Public Media presents the Poetry Radio Project. You can hear unique perspectives on global events and American culture at americanpublicmedia.org/poetry.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday, the 13th of April. Great to have you here. Maybe a better place to be, though, would be inside the corporate suites at Goldman Sachs. Right after the closing bell on Wall Street this afternoon, Goldman reported first quarter profits of $1.5 billion. You roll that in with what we got at the end of last week, that Wells Fargo is expecting $3 billion in black ink when it reports next Wednesday. And what you got is a real head-scratcher. Because a lot of analysts and investors are asking, what's really changed? How can the banks be so good while so much of the rest of the country isn't? Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Skeptics were pouring scorn on Goldman's earnings numbers even before they were released today. They say they make no more sense than Wells Fargo's announcement that it's headed for a record-breaking first quarter. The doubters wonder if the banks are starting to play with expectations, perhaps by not holding back enough cash on hand to cover still mounting loan defaults. Some complain the banks now have wider leeway in valuing their own toxic assets. But at Rockdale Securities, banking analyst Dick Beauvais argues the fundamentals do support these strong earnings.
You've got all these people shooting off their mouths because of these hallucinogenic dreams that they have about where losses are in the banking system. They simply don't want to look at what the real numbers show.
Beauvais points out competition in the banking sector has dried up dramatically. That leaves the survivors in a strong position to make bigger profits lending out what's essentially free government money. At the same time, he contends their losses aren't nearly as dire as had been widely, and he says, wildly predicted. But even if their outlook is improving, market commentator Joe Weisenthal at BusinessInsider.com says it could just compound the credibility issue at the root of their troubles.
What I'm concerned about is that if the banks report very strong earnings, it'll only fuel the fire, fuel the suspicion that the banks are still not being completely forthright and earnings aren't to be trusted yet.
And Weisenthal says that remains the biggest problem the banks need to overcome. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Shares of General Motors took a drubbing today, off 16% on a report in the New York Times that brought fears of bankruptcy bubbling back up. There is speculation that GM and the White House might do something like what was being considered for the banks not too long ago. Two separate companies, a good GM that includes everything that might make money, and a bad GM holding everything that doesn't. A lot of people lose if GM goes under, but Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports some losers are more equal than others.
If GM goes bankrupt, there's an order to who gets repaid and when. Senior debt holders have collateral backing their investments, so they're more likely to get their money back. After that, you look to the bankruptcy code's absolute priority rule for guidance, says Peter Chapman of Bankruptcy Creditors Service.
The absolute priority rule would say no general bondholder recovers anything until all of the senior bondholders are paid in full.
Junior bondholders are further down the line. They're already looking at figures as low as 8 cents on the dollar for their investments, but they got paid a bigger interest rate for their unsecured debt when times were good. Stockholders come right at the end of the line. Chapman says they won't get a dime until the company has repaid its debt.
You can't go out and borrow a bunch of money and then steal it all and get away scot-free, okay?
Well, at least not if you end up in bankruptcy court. Peter Gilhooley is a bankruptcy lawyer at Latham & Watkins. He says stockholders may be nearing a wipeout, but they had the most to gain when GM was doing well.
They have the upside of a value of a solvent enterprise, but when it's insolvent, their equity is worthless.
Those junior bondholders hate the idea of bankruptcy as much as the stockholders do, because if the company does the quick rinse bankruptcy that's expected, bondholders could be arguing over pennies in court for years while the best parts of the company drive off into the distance. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
At least one person is dead and thousands of protesters are still in the streets of Bangkok, Thailand today. The prime minister is promising to restore order, which would be welcome news to foreign investors. Asian stock markets have soared over the past few weeks, even as American indices have posted more moderate rebounds. Marketplace's Caitlin Carroll has more now on political concerns about Asia's emerging economies.
The Asian Development Bank says the political conflict in Thailand could mean its economy will shrink by 5% this year. But that uncertainty may not spill over to other countries in the region. Tu Packard is a senior economist with Moody's.com. She says Asian countries could well learn from Thailand's mistakes.
It's like if you're in kindergarten and another kid in there makes a big mess, you know, you're probably glad that you're not the one making that big mess. And maybe hoping that some of the investment that was going to go to Thailand might come to you, you know, if you behave better.
It's not just good behavior that attracts investment, though. The recent stimulus measures in China have helped stabilize parts of its economy. People there are buying more cars, trade flows are ramping back up, and that supports the economies of China's neighbors. So now, gun-shy foreign investors see an opportunity to catch a lot of these economies on the upswing and make some gains. Ishwar Prasad is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
Foreign investors are beginning to start searching for yield once again, rather than just hunkering down in the safety of U.S. Treasury bonds.
But Quincy Crosby, chief investment strategist with The Hartford, warns that investor optimism isn't limitless.
As far as the stock markets are concerned, at some point they're going to pull back. Markets cannot go up forever, day after day after day.
As for Thailand, she says, once the uncertainty over its future has been priced into stocks, the country's markets will probably see a rebound. I'm Caitlin Carroll for Marketplace.
The White House announced new regulations on Cuba this afternoon. It'll be easier for Cuban Americans to travel and to send money back. It'll be easier for U.S. telecommunications companies to sell services there, although Presidential Press Secretary Robert Gibbs did add that the Cuban government is going to have to agree to that one. On Wall Street today, it was a split decision. We will have the details when we do the numbers. Americans are getting an earlier start than ever racking up credit card bills. A study today from the college financing company Sallie Mae shows last year's seniors graduated with average balances of more than $4,000 on their credit cards. Commentator Megan Daum has some experience with that. She says there is a lesson there, just not the one you might think.
Debt, my father used to say, is the American way of life. He wasn't condoning this, merely pointing it out with the same austere detachment you heard in that famous line from The Graduate, one word, plastics. Still, I took my dad literally. By the time I was 25, I'd acquired no less than 7 credit cards. And granted, in my 20s, I did have some credit card balances that outlasted even my longest relationships. But if you'll forgive my honesty, I'd like to offer up a defense of credit cards. Sure, they can ruin lives, but occasionally they can save them too, or at least help out. Don't try this at home, kids, but in my salad days, I used credit cards not just for actual salad at the supermarket, but for grad school tuition fees, doctor bills, tax payments, household utilities, and, keeping it classy, cash advances for the rent. Okay, not great. But still, thanks to those cards, I was able to pay my professional dues in ways that would have been impossible without them. In other words, even though I did plenty of paid work, I could sometimes take on unpaid work that would lead to bigger things. It wasn't an ideal strategy, but in lieu of underwriting from my family or the NEA, it was the only one I had. Of course, credit was easier to come by in the 1990s. Good luck to the artist who tries to finance his book research or documentary film with a stack of Visa cards today. As President Obama said recently, excess is out of fashion. And though he was talking to bank executives, he might as well have been talking to all of us. But what goes out of style eventually becomes trendy again. And despite the hard lessons we're now learning about the perils of credit, my guess is that when this crisis is over, be it in 5 years or around the time of the next ice age, we'll go back to our debting ways. Why? For one thing, we have short memories in this country. For another, we're tireless believers in the American way of life and the plastic that makes it possible.
Megan Dahm writes a weekly column for the Los Angeles Times. You can write to us if you like. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. Six months ago, this economy was in a different place, and so, in a manner of speaking, were we. Last October, we sent Tess Vigeland and Amy Scott out to answer this question. Had Wall Street helped set this country on the road to ruin? So now, with a hint of economic recovery in the air, we thought it would be interesting to see what people might be saying out there now. So Tess and Amy are off on another excellent adventure. Amy, where'd we track you down?
Well, I'm in lovely Charlotte, North Carolina, where it's a little gray today, but the dogwoods are blooming and spring has definitely arrived. You may recall I started the road trip here last fall because of all the turmoil in the banking industry. But this morning I had coffee with a group of seniors who get together every morning after church and talk about the economy and the stock market, and I'll have more on how they're doing on the show tomorrow.
Perfect. And Tess, where are you?
I'm in Salt Lake City, Kai, where there is still snow in the mountains. And so far, Salt Lake City doesn't seem to be getting as big a hit as perhaps some of the places that Amy is visiting on her trip.
Amy, when we sent you out last fall, we wanted you to look at a bunch of different things, one of which was unemployment. How is what you're seeing now compared to what it was like back last fall?
Well, when I was here last, the national unemployment rate was 6.5%. The economy was already well into a recession, though we didn't know it yet. Now, of course, we're at 8.5%. And it's much worse here in Charlotte. The March figures aren't out yet, but in February, the Charlotte area's unemployment rate was close to 12%. A lot of that is manufacturing and construction jobs, and of course, the banking sector. So the recession has definitely settled in here since I passed through 6 months ago.
Tess, the stock market is not obviously a great economic indicator, but it is one of those things people look at. It stands today, the Dow does, at 7,900, 8,000, something like that. Remind us where it was last fall when you were on the road.
Yeah, you know, Kai, the big worry at that time was that the Dow had dropped to 11,000.
Oh, my.
Seems quaint, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it lost almost 15% that month. The S&P lost almost 17% that month. And, of course, since then, we've watched the Dow drop to 6,500. As you mentioned, it's come up a bit. But really, the world has changed in these last 6 months.
Tess, do me a favor. Put Salt Lake in context today versus last fall.
Well, on October 2nd of last year, I visited Lamb's Grill, which is the power breakfast and lunch spot downtown. And at that time, I asked owner John Spiros how his customers were faring in the early days of the downturn.
I don't know. I'm always too busy to listen to what my customers are saying. But as far as this restaurant goes, I mean, we're actually having a record year.
And in fact, Kai, I visited Spiros just this morning, and it turns out that's exactly what happened. They finished with a record year last year, and the first 3 months of this year, as they celebrate the restaurant's 90th anniversary, these first months of 2009 have been, in his words, huge.
Now, I don't understand it. We see some days that are very spotty with regard to business. but we have continued on a pace that has been quite remarkable in spite of all the things that are going on. And I'd like to think that some of that, again, is because, you know, we're priced fairly reasonably and people can afford to come where they can't go maybe other places.
Now, this was one of those kind of spotty mornings that he mentioned. Very quiet, maybe three or four people at about 8:30. But apparently that's not typical. And remember, this is a restaurant that survived the Depression. The city certainly isn't hurting like some other places in this country, but unemployment is up to more than 5% and saw a big jump in the first couple of months of this year. But as you know, as Amy mentioned, the national rate is now 8.5%.
Tess Vigeland in Salt Lake City for us today. Amy Scott in Charlotte, North Carolina. Before I let you go, guys, Tess, where are you going next?
Kai, I'll be heading to Lincoln, Nebraska to have dinner again with the Landis McKibben family.
Always on the move, Tess. And Amy, where are you?
I'm heading to Youngstown, Ohio, which has the highest unemployment in that state at 13.7% in February. When I was there last fall, locals were hoping the new Chevy Cruze being built nearby would help boost the economy. But, of course, a lot has changed in the auto industry since then, so I'll be checking in on where things stand there.
A lot has. We'll be hearing from you guys all this week on the program. Thanks a lot.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, Kai.
Coming up, e-readers aren't just for books anymore.
Start thinking about them as a way that they can read not only books, but also newspapers and websites and blogs.
But first, let's do the numbers. One step forward, one step back, and one step firmly in place. Dow Industrials dropped 0.3% today, 25 points, wrapped up the day at 8,057. The NASDAQ traded flat, closed at 1,653. The S&P 500 bumped up 0.25%, 2 points, closed at 858. Gotta love those financial stocks, gang. Bank of America charged up more than 15%. Citigroup poured on 25%. A share is now worth about the same as a latte. Goldman Sachs scored a 5% anticipation boost ahead of its earnings announcement that we started with up top. J.P. Morgan Chase deposited nearly 16%. Wells Fargo put on a third of 1%. All downhill for General Motors, though. Lost more than 16%, as I mentioned on news that it's under federal orders to prepare for bankruptcy. Ford, which is in better shape, added 0.5%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.86%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. Missed anything from our special financial crisis coverage? You can listen to the entire show or get our After the Bell podcast, a weekly download of the business stories you need to know. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on retail sales for March. The Labor Department releases its monthly producer price index. And President Obama delivers a speech at Georgetown University. He'll talk about steps that have been taken and work that remains to be done to get the economy moving forward again. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. I suppose this weekend's box office receipts testified to the movie business being recession-proof. $34 million worth of tickets were bought to see the new Hannah Montana movie. It is Hannah's second turn on the big screen. Last year, her concert film was a 3D spectacular. And there are some who think, again, that 3D is the future of movie making. Off-screen, though, there is a bigger battle brewing over who's going to pay for those silly glasses you have to wear. Jill Barchet reports.
Monsters and Aliens, Journey to the Center of the Earth. More than a dozen 3D movies have been released since 2005, and the movie studios have paid for all those plastic glasses. But Fox wants theaters to pick up the tab when it releases Ice Age this summer. George Solomon is the CEO of Southern Theaters. He says the studios are trying to take a big bite out of his revenue.
They want their cake and eat it too, and Fox was going to continue their stance on this, then we would just show it in 35 millimeter and pass the 3D totally.
But this dispute is about more than $1 glasses. Studios have also been paying most of the $75,000 to upgrade movie screens to digital so that they can show 3D. Most theaters still need the upgrade. Marla Backer is an entertainment industry analyst at Research Associates.
This has been the age-old question between the studios and the movie theaters. Who pays? So the glasses is just really a symbol of who's going to bear the bigger cost of actually putting in the equipment.
Theater owners are threatening to boycott Ice Age in 3D, but the movie studios are betting that 3D's popularity will force some theater owners to chill out and pay the bill. In New York, I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
On the small screen, it's not the program content, but the ads that are getting noticed. Political ads, to be precise. They are all over the place, and they're making broadcasters piles of money. Ken Vogel wrote the story for Politico today. Ken, good to have you with us.
Great to be with you, Kai.
I thought the campaign was over. Who's buying these ads?
Well, these ads are coming from a wide variety of groups, advocacy groups, even individuals. We've already seen $270 million from the time that Obama was inaugurated until the end of last month. Usually, in an off year, it takes until September, October to get to that level. I have experts predicting $1 billion in issue ad spending this year. That would be truly unprecedented.
So much of this campaign in the fall was grassroots. Obama drummed it up and got so many supporters and other people trying to do it. Is that what's going on here as well?
Certainly. Barack Obama is using this vaunted email list, this 13 million email list that he assembled during the campaign, which is now in the possession of the Democratic National Committee. They continue to use that list both to drive Obama's agenda, urging folks to call their members of Congress to support his budget, his stimulus package, but also to raise money and then air advertising. So it's kind of a new twist on grassroots advocacy where we're seeing it kind of merge with more traditional air war type of campaign strategies as well.
What issues are being hit? I mean, there's so much that's out there, from healthcare to stimulus to bailouts. What are they like?
We have health care back on the table. We have sort of energy reforms from we see some of the electric utilities advertising on so-called clean coal, whereas some of the environmental groups are really trying to debunk the idea that there can even be clean coal. We have a lot of labor-related issues on the table from this Employee Free Choice Act. And we have these bailouts where companies like General Motors and Ford, they want to say, we saw an ad recently from Ford really highlighting the fact that, hey, we're not in the same kind of boat as GM, and therefore we're more reliable. Well, that's not really a traditional issue ad, and that's not trying to shape policy. But what it is doing is really playing off of the political issues and sort of the public dialogue in play around them.
Is this a windfall that's continuing for the cable companies and the broadcast networks who made so much money off political advertising back in the campaign and now they're still raking it in?
It really is. Of course, we do see car dealerships and the like, which did a lot of the advertising in local newspapers and on local broadcast television, dialing back their advertising budgets. But I think a lot of these stations are hoping that this issue advertising can kind of fill in the gaps here.
Ken Vogel, he covers money and politics for Politico. Ken, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
Entrepreneurs have been trying to figure out better ways to get the printed word into people's hands ever since Gutenberg printed that first Bible 500 years ago. The latest evolution, the e-reader, has been around for a while, and so far sales have been fine. But that may be changing, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman tells us from the Entrepreneurship Desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting.
When you go looking for e-readers these days, there are only two choices with any depth on their e-bookshelves, Sony and Amazon. In spite of its clunky buttons, Sony's Reader has been dubbed sleek and sexy by tech reviewers. As for Amazon's Kindle 2, company VP Ian Fried says it offers lots of market muscle and all the benefits of Wi-Fi.
We put an advanced cell phone radio in the Kindle, which means wherever you are,
you can actually shop from the Kindle and get books delivered in under 60 seconds.
It even knows how to read out loud.
On the island once there were four children whose names were Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy. And it has been told in another book called The Lion, The Witch and the Wardrobe, how they had a remarkable
Imagine that
adventure.
For 250 pages. Still, Wall Street analysts seem impressed with the rest of the Kindle's technology, as well as a new app for the iPhone. But new competition's coming. Fujitsu is launching a $1,000 color reader. It'll be great for graphic novels and surfing the web. The game changer, though, could come from Silicon Valley startup Plastic Logic early next year.
You can bend it, you can roll it, and the image stays on there.
Plastic Logic CEO Richard Archuleta is waving one of his e-reader prototypes in the air. It's like a letter-sized pad of paper and just about as flexible. The screen isn't glass, so it won't break if you drop it or jam it in a briefcase. It's got Wi-Fi and a touch screen. You can load and annotate textbooks, Word documents, whatever.
What you see with the Amazon Kindle and the Sony Reader and other products on the market is they don't do a great job at letting you work with the documents that you create yourself.
Sounds like Archuleta wants to offer us more or less a laptop computer instead, which technology analyst Carl Howe of the Yankee Group says makes perfect sense.
If people can stop thinking about them as it's a way to read a book and start thinking about them as a way that they can read not only books, but also newspapers and websites and blogs, then I think we might be seeing a more mainstream product.
And mainstream media companies are already getting involved. Rupert Murdoch's News Corp is reportedly working on a large-format color e-reader. The Hearst Corporation's got one in the works as well. They're hoping to sell paid subscriptions for their online newspapers and magazines. One possible model, you'll get the media content as a package deal for the first year. News would update and download automatically to the company's e-reader, which you'd have to buy first, of course. Figuring out what to charge won't be easy, though. David Carnoy of CNET thinks putting the right price on the Kindle has been Amazon's biggest challenge.
It's over $400 to buy one of these things. And obviously a lot of people are saying, well, you know, in a year I don't buy $400 worth of books.
I asked Ian Fried if Amazon's price might come down.
No, the Kindle is a great value, being able to take 1,500 books with you, getting New York Times bestsellers and most new releases for $9.99 or less. We have no plans to do that.
Yankee Group analyst Carl Howe thinks the right price is more like $100 to $200, if that.
The best way to market these products is simply, if you buy enough books from my bookstore, then you get the book reader for free.
It might take a giveaway to get consumers to cart around yet another electronic device for their reading material. After all, why pay a few $100 just to read stuff you can increasingly get on your netbook or even your cell phone? I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note today, a postscript of sorts to those Goldman Sachs earnings we started with. Goldman is feeling so good about itself that it's hoping investors do too. Along with the profit report, Goldman announced a $5 billion stock offering today. It's going to use the money to repay part of the $10 billion it got in bailout funds. And if it actually does work, that would make Goldman the first big bank to cut its TARP account balance due. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow shed 25 points, 0.3%. The NASDAQ pretty much flat. The S&P 500 bumped up 2 points, 0.25%. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace is created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time, investing in stocks when your nest egg is already cracked.
If I go back into the market, it'll be tiptoeing because I'm afraid of the bear trap, you know. So much bad news on the horizon. I think we got to play it very carefully.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.